CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.
Welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor of City AM, and we'll launch right into the news, analysis, and interviews that you need for the week ahead in the city. Hello and welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm City AM's acting editor, Andy Sylvester. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Susanna Streeter, the former BBC business correspondent and presenter, and now senior investment and markets analyst at Hargreaves Lansdown. We'll look at the week to come, as well as at UK GDP. And then I'll be joined by Mark Dixon, the boss of FTSE 250 listed IWG Group, whose serviced office brands include Regis. As you can imagine, plenty to say about the future of the city and the office. But another week of twists and turns in the rearview mirror worth spending a couple of minutes on. The big news, of course, is GDP, which I'll talk to Susanna about later. There's plenty elsewhere to get stuck into. For one thing, at least one financial newspaper, not ours, got its pink knickers in quite a twist this week at the news that Amsterdam's trading volumes had eclipsed the City of London for the first time. It's a fairly obvious consequence of Brexit, but the actual act of equity trading is so commoditised and low margin that the economic hit to the square mile, though unwelcome, is pretty marginal. Far more interesting is the word from Andrew Bailey that the UK shan't be a junior partner in negotiations over any future equivalence deal. His Mansion House speech indicates that he shares the view of many in the city, that as time moves on from January the 1st, the benefit of retying ourselves to Europe, clearing aside, becomes far less obvious than the chance to be a bit more innovative on the global stage. Another boss last week may be regretting his speeches, however. KPMG UK chairman Bill Michael has been forced to stand down after being caught on camera, or rather hosting a Zoom meeting for 500 people, telling his staff, essentially, to stop moaning and work harder. The further revelation that he thought unconscious bias was, quote, complete crap, unquote, was the nail in his corporate coffin, at least at KPMG. We're all finding lockdown tough, but my advice to any other big beasts out there is that complaints are best shared with a bottle of Louis Latour rather than a company-wide motivational speech. Better news, though, for other CEOs, not least at AstraZeneca. Good results and more favourable publicity after a massive row with the European Union. Now vindicated by the World Health Organization, CEO Pascal Soriot is being hailed as the mastermind behind the turnaround. It feels a very long time ago that Astra were about to end up in Pfizer's pocket. And more news from the States, too. With Bitcoin on the up, everybody's keen to jump in. Elon Musk found $1.5 billion down the back of his Tesla-shaped sofa to jump in on the cryptocurrency, and mining for the stuff now uses more energy than that used by Argentina. I confess to me it still feels a hell of a lot less stable and appealing than a good Malbec. The mayor of Miami is next up, looking to give his city the power to invest in the stuff with taxpayers' cash. Call me an old skeptic, but that sounds a bit like those unmissable investments in Icelandic banks. And that's quite enough from me on last week. I'm delighted to be joined again by Susanna Streeter, former BBC business presenter and now investment analyst at Hargreaves Lansdown. Susanna, thanks for coming on again.
Lovely to be here.
We usually look at next week, but let's have a quick look at the news from Friday. GDP record slump in the UK. Not as bad as some feared, although analysts were still a little bit sort of not sure which way to go, because you can't really say that GDP figures from looking backwards have any real bearing on the recovery. The question is how quickly vaccines roll out, right?
Absolutely. It is going to depend on that, the rollout of the vaccines, but also the rollout of the mass testing programmes as well. I think that's going to be absolutely crucial. But as you say, the figures that we got out on Friday were slightly better. Anyway, December's were, than was initially expected, with the service industry growing by 1.7% because of that little lockdown reprieve that we got, which meant that overall growth was up 1.2% in December. But as the year as a whole, it was really desperate. So the economy, almost 10% smaller than it was before the pandemic hit. So there is still a real mountain to climb in this recovery, and there will be a lot more pain to come given the current nationwide shutdown. And I think it's the fact that there is no roadmap yet laid out, which is causing so much uncertainty. It's really hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel when the tunnel just keeps getting longer. doesn't it? And we've heard from the Bank of England's chief economist, Andy Haldane. He's been trying to drum up confidence about the economy, forecasting that it will bounce back like a coiled spring as people spend the savings they've amassed during lockdown. But the problem is, at the moment and in the foreseeable future, it's not going to be easy to splash that cash, particularly when we hear that we shouldn't be booking summer holidays. The travel industry is warning that if there's another cancelled summer, many travel firms simply won't survive. So certainly there is a lot of uncertainty around about how quickly the vaccines can roll out and how quickly the economy can bounce back if we return to normal.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And it's notable in the language that's coming out of Downing Street in various anonymous briefings to the papers about how the language just seems to be changing a little bit. It was about overwhelming the NHS. It was about, you know, bringing death rates down. It was about ensuring that we had enough beds in ICU departments. And it now seems to have shifted, and the quarantine policy plays into this as well, towards a slightly more risk-heavy approach, which is keeping mutations out the UK. We can't be sure X, Y, and Z won't, you know, be resistant to vaccines. It does seem to be shifting, and that has a pretty suboptimal result for the economy if that reopening does take a little longer than maybe some are expecting. And the roadmap that you mentioned there, which was due February 22nd, you can already hear the backsliding from Downing Street that'll be the week of the 22nd, and then maybe there won't be enough data. And
it looks as though we might be heading into some kind of twilight world. We've got out of the depths of night, as it were, with such terrible numbers coming through about the, as you say, hospital admissions, but we're kind of going to be in a halfway house, not full restrictions lifted, perhaps until the autumn. And that is certainly going to be very difficult for companies to navigate through, not least the banks. We heard on Friday that there is going to be this recovery in the second half of the year. But until then, unemployment is likely to tick up. Also, we're going to have the pulling back of some of that financial support for individuals and for companies with, for example, loan schemes due to come to an end. Now, that could have an effect on the fortunes of banks like NatWest, for example. Results are due out on Friday. And it's actually had a pretty resilient set of numbers given the economic damage wreaked by COVID on the economy. It has, of course, a large number of small and medium-sized business customers. And although there's been the surge of companies seeking access to emergency funding in the lockdown, it's certainly helped NatWest. Also, the fact that a lot of those loans have been underwritten by the UK government. And so those defaults that it expected earlier on in the pandemic haven't materialised. However, that's not to say that they won't in the months to come if this financial support is withdrawn and the economy doesn't open up quite so quickly.
Yeah, bellwether for the UK economy, that one. A big day for Alison Rose on Friday. We've got Barclays next week, as well as Hays, which again are kind of fit in that basket of you know, good numbers to look at to get a sense of the strength of the economy, the resilience of the economy over the last year, and maybe start teasing out some idea of where we might be going in 2021. I think most people are sort of baking in April, May as a point at which we can start saying that the economy is in some form back to normal. It'll be interesting to see if those guys share those assumptions.
Yeah, I think it's going to shift more towards May, June because of what's been happening. We're already seeing these timetables shift, aren't we? I mean, interesting perspective for Barclays, because it has that really much more resilient trading arm, which has benefited massively from this influx of trading during the pandemic. It's seen its group's investment banking arm rising 24%, accounting for over half the bank's total revenue in the first 9 months. We'll have to see what these results bring. Of course, as well, Barclays is dependent on the direction of interest rates, and it appears as though the prospect for negative rates has been kicked more into the long grass, even though commercial banks were told to prepare for negative rates. The expectation that there will be an economic rebound in the second half of 2021 led many to believe that actually they won't be brought in. But of course, there is still a spectre of that. And if interest rates are kept lower for longer, that really does eat into margins on loans. So again, still a lot of uncertainty surrounding that. But I do think that a flurry of financial market activity we've seen over the past year might well have given Barclays enough insulation to withstand this chill in the lending business. And Hays as well, yeah, as you say, another kind of bellwether of economic activity. It really has suffered during the pandemic. And what will be interesting to watch is the number of permanent placements compared to temporary recruitment, because we did have some readings at the end of last year showing that after a small rise in permanent appointments in the UK in December, they fell sharply again in January as these latest waves of lockdowns took hold across Europe. But there were bright spots in the business as well in Australia when it opened up. So we'll just have to see how the global footprint of Hays has had an impact.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, negative interest rates, it seems to me, the argument seems to be moving towards, or at least the thinking seems to be moving towards an expectation of this, the accidental savings of the British middle class will kind of boost the economy back into full gear in the second half of the year, which I guess reduces the need for negative interest rates, which are designed to encourage that very same thing. So if it's going to happen anyway, you probably wouldn't take that risk. We've all got used to change in the last year, I think it's fair to say, and change at Glencore at the top too.
Yeah, so Glencore has announced a new CEO since we last heard from them. Ivan Glasenberg will be retiring in the first half of 2021 after 19 years at the helm. Now, he's going to be replaced by Gary Nagle, who's currently head of Glencore's coal business. He's been at Glencore since 2000 as well, so a long time at the company for both of them. So I think it's unlikely he's going to make radical changes to the group, which could be beneficial in some ways, but in other ways, there has been criticism about how Glencore has handled the pandemic. It certainly had a tough first half in 2020 due to these lower commodity prices, which led the group to write down the value of some assets and drove it to a $2.6 billion loss. Now, we know that commodity prices have been rising quite sharply since, so we do expect the group to have had a better second half, and this will mean that we'll have a positive impact on the company's future prospects, this price recovery in commodities, because they do look set to make significant gains, not just this year, but over the next few years. And of course, shareholders will be anxious to find out what's happening with the dividend, which was shelved as the group tried to sort its balance sheet out. So I think how successful it's been in reducing its debt levels will depend on whether or not and when the dividend returns.
Fascinating stuff. So honestly, the new CEO there, 2021, 21 years waiting for the top job. It's Prince Charles levels. Susanna, absolute pleasure as ever to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Lovely to be here, as usual.
We'll speak again, I'm sure.
Yes.
And now we're joined by Mark Dixon, the boss of FTSE 250 listed IWG PLC, whose serviced office brand portfolio is led by Regis. The firm has a global footprint, still expanding despite the ravages of the pandemic. Indeed, analysts remain chirpy about the firm, which has spent a decent amount of time trying to future-proof the business, moving on from serviced offices to all sorts of digital offerings. Certainly much more so than competitors like WeWork, whose time in the headlines has rarely been a positive one in recent years. Mark, pleasure to have you on the City View.
Hello, good morning.
We'll talk about 2020, the pandemic, and the future for now. But I think, from what I understand it, the way the business started and the spark of inspiration that gave you the idea for the business probably illustrates a lot of the things that we are going to talk about the future of cities, the future of meeting in person, because it was in-person meetings that you were kind of seeing from across a coffee shop, as I understand it.
Absolutely. I mean, look, when I started the business, it was, you have to think back, that was pre-internet and pretty much pre-mobile phones. So, you know, there were a lot more meetings then. I mean, now technology has advanced a lot and meetings can happen in many different ways, but the importance of representation being local and people getting together will always be there.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen that. I mean, we had our own technical issues this morning that you can never quite be sure of internet technology. But when we think about the way, office spaces, et cetera, are going to change in the future, well, I guess we have to look at the pandemic. People that had maybe never really thought that the digital meeting would would ever become a kind of a uniform approach that people would still want to meet in person. People did. People found it, you know, okay, I think. Take us back to March, April of last year when you're starting to adjust the business to what at that point we probably thought was a few months has obviously turned into a full year. How quickly did you have to pivot in terms of what you were doing and your portfolio, etc.?
Well, I think first of all, look, this is not just about, about meeting. It's about working. So it's a much wider thing. There are more people that work than meet. And our customers had already been making a change to a more digital working practice during 2019 and into the beginning of 2020. So there was already momentum building up for a change in workplace strategies, which we were benefiting from. We had the best first quarter in 2020 that we've had in the history of the business as a result of that. What happened during COVID was that the proof point came that companies can continue to work, continue to be as productive as they were before, or in some cases even more productive by using the technology that was already there. So Zoom, Teams, Google, people could work like this, and people could work remotely at home or at a local office. They didn't necessarily need to commute into a central office. So it was quite an easy change for customers to just accelerate the strategy. The workplace still worked. It's something that's going to stay in the future, but it's a hybrid work practice in the future that you're going to see. So there is still a role for the headquarters, the place where people get together. In fact, it becomes even more important in a decentralized hybrid world for companies to bring people together to collaborate, to feel they belong to the company and so on. They're just not going to do it every day. And that's the real big change.
Yeah, and how does a company like yours respond to that? Because there's a lot more to it than opening the doors in the morning and closing them in the evening.
Yeah, look, we have, our response to all this, it's there in our numbers. We're really pleased that we've got such a good representation in the provinces and in smaller towns and around the country, UK, whether that's the UK or any of the other 120 countries we're in, because that's where people migrated to. So a lot of people cannot or really don't want to work from home, but these people have taken a local office for the first time. And so the response basically has been led by our customers, by them, changing geographically where they are working. And, that culminated with the largest contract that we've signed so far with Standard Chartered Bank about 5 or 6 weeks ago. And that was for 95,000 people. And that's part of a series of deals where companies are wholesale moving to a more hybrid way of working. Better for people. It's great economics for the company, and it adds a whole new level of flexibility that wasn't there before. And productivity is not affected. So our response has been to launch more products for home working that support home working, support hybrid working, and those have gone very well in the past year. Our downtown city centre business has been badly affected. And numbers have been affected. But the other part of the business, the virtual, and the provincial has done very well.
And do you see those city centre sites re-emerging in the future, I suppose? Do you think that kind of the desire for meeting in those locations, which has been around for, centuries, right? Do you think that will be completely disrupted by the digital revolution and by this sort of forced, as you say, proof point?
It'll be completely disrupted, but it's a sort of slow motion crash. It's not something that there will be quite a dramatic early change, but it takes time. And the reason it takes time is it takes time for companies to establish new work practices. It takes time for companies to get out of their existing commitments. A flexible and hybrid work platform obviously works best when you can get out of your existing arrangements. So companies will have less space in metropolitan cities. They will not bring in large numbers of people to all work in the same building, because there won't be a need for that, not for all companies, but probably for a good half of all companies will adopt hybrid working. So what this means is less demand for space in downtown areas, more demand in the provinces and near where the centers of population are. So, you know, former commuter towns or dormitory towns will become much more vibrant places over the next 4 or 5 years. As companies sort of migrate their people closer to where they live and do all the commuting using technology. Companies themselves will still have headquarters in the cities, because it's very important and they're very good places to go to. All the logistics in places like the UK, all roads lead to London and all railway lines lead to London. Therefore, you know, it's a great place to bring people together to collaborate and so on. You just have less space. Over a longer period of time, large cities will have to reprice and become more livable in order to be successful in the long term. Places like London, San Francisco, New York got overpriced. You know, London is just incredibly expensive both to work in, if you're a company employing people, or to live in, and your people therefore have to live, you know, a long way away in order to have affordability for homes and so on. So, and we've seen this during the crisis, livable cities, that is cities where more people live in the city and commute much shorter distances, did a lot better than those cities where there's a long commute. So cities will reprice. It happens naturally. It's happened after every crisis in New York City.
Yeah, of course. I mean, when you think about those major cities, I mean, New York went literally bankrupt in the 70s, and it took a while to rebound. But
they sort of rejuvenate. It's simply pricing. I mean, I'll give you an example. Detroit, downtown Detroit, we're doing a new development there with some partners. It's a great development in downtown Detroit. Now, Detroit was a booming city in the early part of the 20th century. But, you know, it became a ghost town, but it totally repriced, and there's a lot of talent in the area that's still there. So if you can rejuvenate these places and bring people back in, if it reprices, money comes back in, and, you know, it was always a good place to be, all the amenities are there, but, you know, it has to be affordable.
Yeah, of course. And even, you know, you sound very optimistic, and I think I sort of understand why. And it's that footprint outside of those cities, at least in the short and medium term, which obviously a lot of your, you know, pseudo competitors, for want of a better phrase, don't necessarily have. Is the plan to still continue expansion? I know you went into Honduras, Grand Cayman in 2020. I know there's IWG's taking a stake in another co-working space in the States. Is the plan to continue expanding when others are sort of sitting on the chair waiting to see where the wind blows?
Well, they're either sitting on the chair or they've been blown off by the wind.
Yeah, quite.
You know, this is, look, the reason, the purpose, the reason for our business existing is more relevant today than it's been at any time in the 30 years since I established the business in Brussels, 1989. Digital working is the way people will work in the future, and it's the way many modern companies work today. And so in order to do proper digital working, that means, by the way, you know, your office sits in the cloud. It's not a physical place. The office is in the cloud. You choose a physical place that makes sense for you to be productive, to do your work, on that particular day or that particular time. And that could be at home, that could be anywhere. So, you know, in terms of our growth, yes, we are adding large numbers of centres to our physical platform. So we've got rapid growth occurring through franchising and joint venturing to enlarge the platform. This is a business that responds well to scale. It needs scale. And the second thing, part of the business that's growing, is the virtual membership. So that is people that actually don't have an office, but they become a member of the system and they're users of the system. And those numbers are growing very quickly. At the moment, we're supporting over 1 million people working from home, and we have just over, a little over 7 million actual users. So, you know, this part of the business is another growth area, and that really fits into supporting a new sort of digital workforce, hybrid workforce that's going to be out there. It's what companies want. It's what people want. It's going to happen. It is happening. But you need the physical and the virtual to make it work, the platform and then the physical locations. So we are, you know, we are very much focused on that and are doing a lot of growth at the moment.
Well, that's fascinating. But before we let you leave, Mark, one other question I feel obliged to ask as someone who is looking very much forward to the weekend and a glass of wine. Something that can be done only in a physical location. You've obviously sort of branched into vineyards over recent years. How's it looking this year? How are conditions this year on your vineyards?
Well, the UK vineyards are under, last time I looked, I think about 4 inches of snow, which is good, actually. It's a very good thing because that cleanses the ground of lots of, freezes the ground, freezes all the microbes and so on. So we like that. But, you know, overall conditions, too early to say. You know, farming's a lot more unpredictable, unfortunately, than offices and in that you're at the mercy of the weather. So if you ask me that question in the spring, you know, our big enemy, both in the south of France where I have vineyards and in the UK, the enemy is frost. So if we get past the frost, then we're in good shape. But sales of wine are very buoyant, actually. You know, basically, a lot more people are drinking wine at home. So, you know, we're selling a lot online. And, you know, from a sales point of view, the wine business has not been affected. I think the consumption's actually gone up.
Yeah, that, I have to confess, does not surprise me sometimes on days working from home when you see the same four walls all day. I think a glass of wine at the end of the day is a nice way to break it up. Look, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. A real pleasure to hear from you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the time.
And that's all from us at the City View in partnership with CMC Markets. Do see us again next week. That was the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, all the news, analysis, and opinion you need will be on cityam.com.
CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently.
76% of retail investor accounts lose money.